Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this week we are doing something very slightly different. We are changing the format. In the second half of this week's episode, we're going to be doing one of the interviews you know and love with one of the writers from the magazine. But in the first half of today's episode, we are going to be talking a little bit about the news with a panel consisting of the magazine's editor, Ian Hislop, and two of the magazine's writers, Adam McQueen and Helen Lewis. We are recording this 5 days after the last magazine arrived on people's doormats, and we thought it would be fun to talk about how the news might have changed, what stories we got right, what stories might have moved on in interesting and unexpected ways since the last issue of the magazine. So, the one thing I think we all wanted to talk about, we don't like looking at the past at Private Eye, you know, we don't like looking way back. I thought it would be fun to talk about someone new. So, in particular, I don't know if any of you three have noticed, but there is a new journalist on the scene in Fleet Street, new columnist, really exciting. He's arrived at the Daily Mail and he's making waves already. He's called Boris Johnson. Did any of you see this?
I did. I will confess I did. I might be the only person in this room who quite enjoyed the column. I was like, oh, it's going to be on this boring sort of like my revenge. You know, I always think there's a thing where people do where they do either a piece of work or something that's essentially titled An Answer to My Critics. You know, there's a lot of tweets that are like that. So I was quite pleased he wrote about Ozempic, the weight loss drug. And he said he's basically eaten through it, which I enjoyed. He's still raiding the fridge. There was a piece of research that suggested that one of the things that Ozempic also does is it helps you quit all your other bad habits. People reported like they bit their nails less, they compulsively gambled less. So my theory is the reason he stopped is it also stopped him wanting to philander, and he was like, well, what's the point of being alive?
I would love to have been a fly on the wall in Paul Dacre and Ted Verity's offices at the moment when that copy landed, because I'm sure, do you think that was what they were expecting? The new diet columnist, really? Is that what we're going for?
When I worked for Dacre, I had a very strange habit of calling all the very senior men in the office, particularly the posh ones, darling. So I slightly have an imagine where he phones up, Boris Johnson, great column, darling, but could you make it less about you eating cheese?
Ian, we don't get darlinged at all at the Private Eye office.
No, but you don't get the C word either when he doesn't like the copy. No, I read it and I thought, oh, well, what's Boris lost? Well, he's lost his seat. And then I reverted to my traditional laughter, which again, I'm afraid my reaction to this was, I thought, well, did the Mail get him? Was there a bidding war? Mm-hmm. I mean, Adam, surely the Telegraph tried to get him again, or the Times.
Well, the Telegraph haven't got any money. I think their bank accounts will be frozen now, haven't they? So there's not a lot. They'd have to just say, well, you know, we might be able to pay you at some point once the Barclays have paid off absolutely, and Lloyd's Bank have paid off absolutely everybody else. So I suspect they were probably out of the running in that sense. I suspect, I have a theory that Rupert Murdoch, do you remember there was that trip where Rupert Murdoch paid, and he hardly ever pays anyone that he doesn't have to, paid Boris to go over to his ranch in America for a slightly mysterious weekend, and the only thing that actually emerged from that is that Boris has sold his memoirs to HarperCollins, which is Murdoch's publishing company. So it's going to be interesting to see whether they come out first with a very big advance from Murdoch, or that book about Shakespeare that's been he's been supposed to write for about the last 8 years or something.
Well, I mean, he has got a new job, but again, there are some people, you said, has the news changed at all? It hasn't, and despite being told there would be, you know, a serious revolt, and lots of other people would come up for, but this hasn't happened, which made me think, probably for the first time in a long time, maybe it is the end.
A series of revolts have been heralded in the past and haven't come to, I mean, in the past year. Since
he's got into this habit, hasn't he, of marching all of his troops up to the top of the hill, having a look at them and going, oh dear, it's only Jacob Rees-Mogg and Nadine, and then just sort of marching them back down again, hasn't it? Was it 21 people who managed to turn out for
the Belfast Agreement.
The Brexit thing, yeah. And then this time it was, I mean, there were a couple more than Jacob and Nadine, weren't there? But there weren't many more. I think it was up to about 8 who'd actually put their name to anything.
Yeah, I think that was the Belfast Agreement was a time when I thought, oh no, he's slipping, his powers are slipping. And I think you have to now, if he's going to get back in as an MP, that essentially has to be signed off by the party leader, and that no future party leader is going to want him hanging around going, do you know who'd be a better party leader? It's me. And, you know, then people said, well, what if he came back as Mayor of London? But again, that relies on the thesis that people who, like, remainy Londoners, and London's a pretty remainy city, have not been totally polarised against him by Brexit, which I just don't see. You know, there's quite good polling that he's incredibly unpopular. This myth of Boris' popularity has been, you know, very durable. But I just don't, what's his constituency anymore? I don't want to read the last rites because it feels like tempting fate, doesn't it?
Yes, well, I mean, some of our readers, I mean, there was a letter saying, well, he was Mayor of London and he was Prime Minister, so ha, ha, ha to you. Which is not very polite. And another one saying, his lot's an absolute disgrace. He criticises everyone and thinks he's perfect. Boris is 10 times the man that little shit will ever be.
Wow.
Yeah, but that was me, to be fair.
I just add that to say there is a constituency out there, and I know that Nadine didn't actually sign that email. She's got a column on the Mail as well, though.
It is a bit weird seeing the entire parliamentary party draining towards either the Mail or Talk TV. The Talk TV and GB News, up to 8 or 9 Tory MPs between them, I think.
Yeah, they didn't have to give up their jobs, did they? Which Boris did, and Nadine said she was going to, and then hasn't actually. But no, you now appear to be able to present news programmes or current affairs programmes, at least. That's the nice distinction that Ofcom are making, isn't it? While still being a sitting MP. But I mean, journalistically, I mean, would you have a serving MP write for you? It's a bit... It's slightly odd, isn't it?
I mean, if only we'd had Paul Dacre as head of Ofcom, he could have investigated this. I mean, that would have made a lot more sense than just ignoring him for a peerage.
Yeah, but it feels like the Tories have already gone into opposition, which is a neat trick to play when they've still got another year of their term, right?
They do seem to have just given up on it, don't they? Entirely that. Well, the Mail equally had a page last week where they had pictures of kind of eco-protesters and things that said, a vision of Keir's Britain. You said, no, this isn't actual vision of Rishi Sunak's Britain. This is happening right now. What are you on about? It's like, they've gone through some weird time portal over in Derry Street where they've gone forward a couple of years. It's bizarre.
I'm annoyed about that. Nadine rendered one of our articles inaccurate by virtue of flip-flopping over whether she was quitting or not, which I was very annoyed about.
We should say we're recording this on Monday, so this may have completely changed. She may have quit two more times and then decided she's not by the time this actually comes out.
We're recording this before Nadine has quit, if she does, and before the parliamentary debate about the committee's verdict on Johnson, which looks like it might just get nodded through but might be debated after all and voted on. The Nadine thing was about her interests at the Daily Mail and Talk TV. Because she hasn't declared... this is the really interesting thing. She hasn't declared either gig in the Register of Members' Interests. Both have been going for longer than you have to declare the rules. It's, I think, 28 days that you have. One of them is going on for a month and a half. One of them has been going on for 4 months or longer, 5 months, the Talk TV show hasn't appeared. And one of our colleagues wrote to her office and said, why aren't these in the register? And she said, oh, well, I just haven't invoiced yet. And as soon as I get around to it, they'll be appearing. Only to announce she was then quitting.
This is, of course, Nadine, who talks about posh boys who don't know the price of milk, but apparently doesn't need to be paid for one of her jobs for 5 months at a time.
Cost of living crisis? Every other freelance journalist, the way that it normally works is you invoice and then the other side wait 4 months
to pay
you.
Right. No.
She's got it completely wrong.
Exactly. But her vision of who is a posh boy is slightly odd, isn't it?
Not Boris, yes. No. Yeah, who got a scholarship to Eton, so yeah. That's completely different.
He's blue collar. I was in Bedfordshire the other day for a talk, and it was really interesting meeting some of her constituents who were, as far as I could tell, quite cross with her. I spoke to one lady who said, you know, well, we didn't vote for her. And I said, well, quite a lot of you did. And she said, yeah, we're trying to find them.
A witch hunt. Yeah. Excellent.
And no, you glossed over what you're actually there for. Are you going to stand? Are you the next Tory candidate?
I couldn't
say. Are we going the other way, that the Daily Mail is now taking politicians as columnists? We're sending our hacks off to become MPs.
Yeah.
No, I'm still very interested in the Boris tantrum, in which he talked about a witch hunt and... which, again, everyone said this is very like Trump, but I'd forgotten this is exactly what they said about Owen Paterson, which was the last time that Boris actually led a witch hunt against the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner. You remember Catherine Stone?
Yeah.
And essentially, one of his MPs had been caught out lobbying, and Boris tried to close down Parliament and change the system, which is quite extreme. So again, I think our surprise that he'd behaved incredibly badly when he himself had been caught, we should have remembered just how badly.
Yeah. And you have met two of the, I'm going to call them witch finders in this case, because you've appeared in front of them at Parliament, Bernard Jenkin and Alberto Costa, is it?
Yes, and both of them were on the Standards Committee, which asked myself and Richard Brooks and Solomon Hughes to go in and talk about the business of lobbying and having second jobs. And
they're Conservatives on the seven-strong committee that ruled on Boris.
They
so
are
two of the four
senior Tories on the committee. But any suggestion that these are two extreme socialists who've been infiltrated onto the committee to defeat Brexit and Boris is straightforward cobblers, like nearly all rumours. The fact that those two came down harshly... on Boris is just incredible evidence that the committee was going to get him on the basis of, I know this is controversial, but of the evidence.
I think there was a great deal of schadenfreude from some quarters. An MP told me last week that they saw Theresa May and Harriet Harman chatting at the bar of the House and was going, I wish I could have heard it. I could just imagine sort of like the sort of posters on Bin Laden, like, we got him. Put him down.
But I think that was the prime example of just quite how spectacularly unhinged the tantrum was, wasn't it? That this, that it's all being done to undo Brexit. And one of the chief witchfinders involved in this is Bernard Jenkin. I mean, there is no one.
No one loves Brexit.
No
more.
One more pro-Brexit than Bernard Jenkin, surely. Yeah.
We should briefly talk about the honours list as well. The fact of Boris, I don't want to bandy about the word disgrace, but Boris resigning now, in whatever state, that has no impact at all on the list that's been now approved and gone through. I know a couple of names were removed in advance, but I mean, in the latest issue of the Mag, we've written, you know, the very first piece, first page, is about the list and the number of people on it for reasons of patronage and cronyism, and it's all of them.
It's the lot. Yeah. But also, I mean, again, I mean, that piece does point out that it was COVID avoiders and COVID rule breakers, and Sean Bailey, Lord Bailey of...
Lord Bailey of Jingle and Mingle. So I hope he's known.
He was on the list.
He was very lucky to have snuck on that list. If that person had leaked the mirror recording of that COVID Christmas party a couple of weeks earlier, I don't know whether or not he could have survived on that list. Because, again, another great piece of work by the Met Police, who had the photo of them all standing next to each other and said, well, who can say if they were breaking the rule? But now I've seen the video of them dancing with each other and saying things like, are you sure we should be filming this?
The it's a bit police, of a giveaway, isn't it?
They're going to have another look at it. I mean, incredible.
The list of names is extraordinary. We've now got Dame Priti Patel and Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg. It's Sir Michael Fabricant, which, we're all going to have to get used to saying.
Are we? What if we just didn't?
Well, there was a suggestion. Someone in the Commons said these should be annulled, which I thought was a good suggestion.
Yeah, apparently you need an Act of Parliament to annul a peerage. So they would have to actually have a vote on it. That's my understanding of it. It's quite hard once it's been done.
Well, they don't have anything else to vote on at the moment, though.
They make those rules up as they go along, though, don't they? Because you know, remember that when Jimmy Savile, when everything was exposed about him, they said, there is no possible way you can take away a knighthood retrospectively. But apparently now we find out with Martin Amis last week, you can award one posthumously.
So yes.
How does that work?
Oh, I think they got his to him on the last day, and they claim they snuck it under the wire by telling him about it. As long as you've told someone about it.
Did they? Yeah. Right. Sorry, I missed that.
Sir Martin Amis, the late.
He got told about it the day before he died, apparently,
And I mean, obviously, the eye isn't very thrilled that Ben Hoochin is now Lord Hoochin when, you know, there is a parliamentary panel looking into Teesside, and there are a number of these honours that could perhaps have been delayed a bit until we know the truth of the matter.
Okay, well, let's move on then to slaps. So, Adam, I think you've been writing a little bit about this in the latest issue.
Yes, Mohammed Amirsi, who was finally kicked out of court and told that his slap action against Charlotte Leslie, the former Tory MP, could not continue.
Just for the readers who don't know who Mohammed Amirsi is, I think we should say that.
So briefly, Mohammed Amirsi is a man who has had a colourful and interesting business career. I'm not going to go any further than that. He's also a large donor to the Tory party, and he wanted a part in the Tory party in running a sort of conservative Friends of the Middle East group. And in the process of this, he got very, very cross with a former Tory MP called Charlotte Leslie, who had circulated a memo to, accounts differ, but up to about 13 different people. And as a result of this, she was hit with two data protection actions at the High Court and an enormous libel action, which Mohammed Amirsi wanted to bring against it. It was done with the help of the Eye's favourite law firm, Carter Fuck. And it was an absolute classic of the genre of these strategic lawsuits against public participation. Essentially, it was completely and utterly out of all proportion to any damage that could have been done by, you know, not a TV programme, not a book, not the front page of a newspaper, literally a memo that was circulated to a small number of people.
And by a Tory MP.
Yes.
Who'd also been on this committee beforehand. And who had legitimate interests in talking about who should have a role in a parliamentary committee focusing on the Middle East. And Mr. Amirsi is a controversial and colourful character who you are entitled to think it would be better if we didn't have him on the committee. That is a perfectly legitimate view. And I say that in the full light of this marvellous judicial slapping down of Mr. Mercy.
Am I right in thinking, Adam, that actually the judge didn't rule that it was a slap because the case was just really, really rubbish apart from that?
Essentially, that was it. I mean, it was the most wonderful sort of legal case where it was a huge dressing down for Carter Rugg.
Ian, has Private Eye come in for one of these slaps in the past? Has there ever been one against us?
They weren't called slaps, I think, in the old days.
Yeah. Slaps is the power of an acronym, isn't it? It works really, really well. It sounds right, yes, doesn't it? They're called lawfare for a while.
I would say all of the major actions against us, including, I mean, the last ones, would qualify as very, very rich people thinking we can just throw money at you and this will shut you up. And I think that's largely slaps. I mean, now it's more oligarch-based and sort of foreign powerful interests. But again, the principle is exactly the same. It's saying, I'm very rich, I can afford these lawyers forever, we will just string this out until you're bankrupt. And poor old Charlotte Leslie, again, is not someone who has any money.
Helen, you were saying, just before we started recording, you were saying something about the increase of crowdfunded lawsuits and crowdfunded law.
Yeah, basically. I think it's really interesting how that has changed really in the last couple of years, because in a way it's a great antidote to some of these. You know, they're just the complete inequality in the legal system, but who's got the most money can just string it out for the longest time. So there has been this real surge of people looking at crowdfunded lawsuits. So I'm thinking of Carol Cadwallader and Aaron Banks, for example, Jack Monroe, the food blogger, in various actions of hers, and then Jolyon Morn of Good Law Project. And the thing that's been really interesting is, in a way, I really welcome them, because it does attempt to redress the balance, right? It does attempt to say we're going to put everybody back on a legal footing. But I also think there's a downside to them, in the sense that there is very little monitoring about what the actions are used for, you know, how often they succeed. Are people kind of essentially contributing to a cause rather than an actual specific lawsuit that you can point to, and the chances of success? So that's the other kind of weird side of what's happened. If you've got very rich individuals just pursuing people forever and a kind of grassroots movement to start particularly bringing judicial reviews. That's the kind of big mechanism now.
Yes. And there was, I believe, a process underway to clamp down on potentially vexatious uses of the judicial review. The government announced that. Although shortly afterwards, I think the government announced they were launching a judicial review against the COVID inquiry.
The one they set
their
up,
own
yeah.
inquiry yeah. to stop them. Yes.
It's about whether or not you have standing. So you can't kind of just glom onto stuff and say, you know, which I think the Good Law Project was accused of several times, saying we're just an outfit that does these. Right. You actually have to bring a judicial review, have to have some personal stake in whatever's being done.
Well, I'm sure Rishi Sunak does have a personal stake in all of the governmental WhatsApp's
not being
published.
Coming out.
Well, that sounds completely legit then. Fine. Moving on. And we started with the bidding war for Boris Johnson. I think that's the other thing that we ought to talk about today, is Private Eye's bid to buy the Telegraph and Spectator. Ian, we were talking about it. We wanted to clear it with you first, obviously, but we feel there's a lot of cross-promotional synergy that we could get between the titles.
Yeah, I just think the price of... You were suggesting a fiver for the lot, I think, is too much.
But look at the comedy characters you get for that. I mean, you get Alistair Heath, you get Sherelle Jacobs, you get Janet Daly.
You sound a bit like Oprah then. Like, you get a Janet Daly. You get a Janet Daly. Isn't it, it's valued, what, $600 million for the two? Which was a suggestion that people would pay highly for them because they were a quote-unquote trophy asset, which suggests that people regard the Telegraph rather more differently than I do.
Well, people have always wanted newspapers, haven't they? Mm. That's the odd thing about the Telegraph, is traditionally, if you've made a lot of money somewhere else, you want to buy a newspaper because it gives you political power. But actually, with the Telegraph has been profitable. It has been profitable over the last decade, and it's been profitable because they've chiseled out every possible bit of money that they can. They've cut everything right down to the bone. It's why the entire newspaper is largely written by Bryony Gordon now.
But also an appalling exaggeration.
It's very unfair on Alison Pearson, who writes the other half.
Yeah, she does about half. She does the other half.
The other thing I was interested in is whether or not... It seemed to me that lots and lots of people want to buy The Spectator, and maybe you know the people behind The Critic, which is another new magazine, might be interested in that, or... the people behind Unheard, for example, would like to have a kind of print product to go with that kind of new right stuff. But there's less interest maybe in the Telegraph per se. I don't know whether... Do you think they will definitely keep them as a bundle you have to buy?
No, I don't. I think negotiations have already started on that. There was a very odd story which I wrote about in the last eye, where the Mail on Sunday said, Boris Johnson could be the next editor of The Spectator when Rupert Murdoch buys it. And then about six paragraphs in, it says, only Boris Johnson is telling people this story. It's not actually true. And I think that was the beginning of negotiation, because I think the Mail group are very much out. They want the Telegraph. They'd quite like a broadsheet, and I think they'd be quite happy for the Spectator to go off make it a bit cheaper if that's bought somewhere else.
But publisher.
Well, or to Rupert Murdoch, who I think would quite like that. The Spectator is probably more of a trophy just because magazines are amazing.
I mean, over the last decade, I mean, the Telegraph has made a lot of money, and we know this because every year Telegraph journalists send us complaints saying, have you seen how much money the Telegraph Group has made? None of it's coming our way. And this has been a repeated theme. So, I mean, I do think, you know, the Telegraph is, you know, doolally or not, is sort of viable.
Well, it is, and that actually is the root of this problem, because the reason that the Barclay brothers have lost control of the Telegraph and the Spectator is nothing to do with the way that they've been running them. It's to do with the fact that they were the only viable parts of their business, because the other things that they own, like the Littlewoods catalogue and Yodel, the delivery company, were hemorrhaging money for so many years that effectively they had to borrow against the only assets they had. It was kind of the family silver. And it turns out they've taken debts totalling nearly £1 billion, basically against the Telegraph and the Spectator, which is the one bit that now have now been taken into liquidation by the bank to whom they owe that money, and are being sold off as those jewels that might make a bit of money back.
Mm. There are rules about how much of particular bits of the media you're allowed to own, aren't there? About the proportion, of TV channels.
They used to be. But
there are about television, though. That was the thing when Murdoch was setting up Sky, wasn't it? That he had to hive off bits of it so that he didn't own too high a proportion.
It absolutely was, and it was a very big thing when Murdoch bought The Times as well back in 1981. It was huge. But the problem is, so few people have the money to buy newspapers and want to buy newspapers now that effectively the authorities have taken the view in recent years that it's better to keep these things going and you kind of put that aside. So, for instance, the Mirror and Express title. So you're talking three newspapers in the Mirror stable and four in the Express stable as well, if you count Sunday papers as well, are all owned by the same company now. In 2018, they were all taken over by Reach, and that gives them an enormous proportion of the market. But it was ruled then that was kind of all right. And in a way, that's slightly tragically for journalists, that was because newspapers are now thought to have so much less heft than they had back in the old days, because so many fewer people are going out and buying them. So you will have a proportion of the market which is enormous, but the market is so much smaller that that's not necessarily such a problem anymore.
And Reach doesn't have a central figure who's over 100, who people can focus on. Because they're a conglomerate, as it were, people are much less worried. You don't think, I'm going to get Rupert Murdoch's views, or I'm going to get the Barclay brothers' worldview from a small island off the Channel Islands inside a moat coming out at me.
You're making me nostalgic now. I'm going to miss them so much. Where have all the great Bond villain press proprietors gone? This is the last of them, isn't it?
Well, it's Musk now, isn't it? They've moved on.
We're all forgetting Yevgeny Lebedev, who remains absolutely behind.
Lord Yevgeny Lebedev. Baron, let's not forget, even ahead of all of the other corrupt Johnson appointments.
Absolutely. Baron of Hampton and Siberia.
Yes.
Who remains behind The Independent, and, you know, long may that last.
And The Evening Standard. And was responsible for a very, very good joke of someone saying, have you got the right papers? And he says, yes, I've got The Independent and The Standard.
Ian Hislop there. Thanks to him, Helen Lewis and Adam McQueen, and you will be hearing some combination of them or The Eyes Are the Writers next time. Now, in the first half of today's show, we made reference to the government launching a judicial review against its own COVID inquiry. The inquiry has been in the news a great deal recently because it's just started taking evidence, and one man who knows an enormous amount about the inquiry and about public inquiries in general is MD, aka Phil Hammond, Private Eye's medical correspondent. I sat down for a chat with him and started off by asking him what exactly this inquiry is going to be actually looking into, because there are so many different things that it could be. Here's Phil.
Yes, and we're finally hearing witnesses just 3 years after the first lockdown and 2 years after the last lockdown. And so speed is of the essence. It's moving at the speed of a glacier, I think, because of its thoroughness. It's interesting. Most countries haven't had a judicial public inquiry. And I guess the strength of it is that it can compel people to give evidence under oath, and it can compel the production of evidence, hopefully unredacted. And what it's trying to do, I mean, part of it, I think, there's a part of the grieving process. It needs to hear arguments from all sides. It needs to hear people who are arguing that lockdown wasn't a good idea versus people who argue that they were. It needs to hear about the benefits of vaccines, and it needs to hear about people who were harmed from vaccines. So part of that thing is, you know, in the first week, we've heard Michael Marmot, who staked his career on exposing health inequalities, saying how appalling the recession and austerity was for our pandemic preparation. It made things far worse for the poor. And then you had David Cameron fiercely defending his austerity policy, saying if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have the funding for the NHS. So it hears both sides of the arguments in enormous detail. And then sometime, maybe in 20 years' time, it comes up with a conclusion. And interestingly, although it has powers to compel people to give evidence, the government completely ignore it if they wanted to. So in an imaginary world in 15 years' time when it reports, if Boris Johnson was prime minister again, he could say, oh, this public inquiry is a kangaroo court. They issued me with a salmon letter criticising me and it's absolute tosh and nonsense and I'm taking no notice of it whatsoever. I'm not saying that will happen, but it's worth remembering at the end of the day, the government chooses which of its recommendations it adopts and which it chooses to ignore.
It's a strange thing where you're saying this is a good thing that it's happening and that it needs to happen and that it's part of the process and that a lot of other countries aren't doing it or certainly aren't doing it yet, but also that we're not going to get very much useful practical advice out of it. It's a funny balance.
We might. I mean, my only experience of this is, you know, I was summoned to give evidence at the Bristol Heart Inquiry and I was told before I gave evidence that they'd give me a bit of a going over on the witness stand because they had to be seen to, you know.
Just for listeners who haven't heard you talking about the Bristol Heart Inquiry before, can you briefly summarise what
pretty
it
much
about?
The first story I broke when I propositioned Mr. Hislop in the toilet at a BBC Radio Light Entertainment Christmas party in 1991 and offered him a provisional column. And in 1992, I talked about junior doctors' working conditions, but I also learnt, because I was living in Bristol, that far too many babies were dying after heart surgery in Bristol and had data to back up that claim. And we published it in the Eye four times. And 7 years later, what was then the largest public inquiry in British history has been usurped by many others since. But that was... And I was summoned to give evidence. I outed myself as Private Eyes MD. And it was very thorough. And they gave me a tough old time. They sent me a salmon letter saying that, you know, I broke this big story on the stage in a comedy double X, Struck Off and Die, and in the satirical magazine Private Eye, when I should have gone through the correct channels. But interestingly, they did an audit of all the Private Eye columns and found that they were read by the General Medical Council. They were read in the Department of Health. They knew perfectly well what was happening. They just didn't act. So even if I'd gone through the correct channels, it wouldn't have changed anything. And I was let off the hook. But it was, you know, they do. When you're under scrutiny in one of those inquiries, and I didn't have any legal advice, it is pretty unpleasant and forensic. And I'm glad that's happening because I think that's the best way of testing the arguments. And although they don't find people guilty or innocent, they can be minded to criticise people who they think whose behaviour or actions should have been better and they should have known that at the time. So they could criticise Boris Johnson. And we already know how well he takes criticism. And he'll probably have a big hissy fit and resign from the after-dinner speaking circuit or whatever he happens to be doing at the time.
So the recommendations, are these likely to be practical ones in terms of stocks of PPE or pandemic plans, or are they more cultural or conceptual ones?
There was a great sentence. Judge Hallett, Heather Hallett, who's overseeing it, said that her job was to look at harm and loss in its broadest sense and see whether that was inevitable or whether some of it could have been avoided. And the difficulty, as I repeatedly said in the Eye, is that everything you do in a pandemic harms someone. So every, you know, and it's really hard. What you're trying to do is to do the least harm to the most people. And that's really hard. So you'll hear from people whose businesses were destroyed. You'll hear from young people whose education and mental health was destroyed. You'll hear from people in care homes who lost loved ones, etc. And suddenly you've got to balance all these competing harms and come up with some magic formula next time. But remembering that this was a really difficult virus to spot, as I said again, is that it spread largely asymptomatically or with minimal symptoms. And then it was, you could predict vulnerable, poorer people in certain ethnic minorities, older people with diseases who are most likely to suffer from it. But it was extremely hard to stop. And the next pandemic may be a different virus altogether, or a variation of this one, or influenza, or whatever. So I don't know at the end of the day how much of practical use will come out of it. You'd like to think something will, but, you know, my hunch is if a pandemic happened again anytime soon, we'd have an equally poor response. If you look at the state of the NHS, you look at the state of public health, we've already wound down our vaccine development and drug development. We've wound down test and trace. Whether we could wind them up again really quickly if another pandemic came along, I don't know. But if you look at the state of the waiting lists at the moment, the state of long COVID, the number of people off permanent sick and disabled, The crisis in emergency medicine. The National Audit Office is producing a report tomorrow outlining how we're struggling to cope. The mental health of workforce, particularly in the emergency departments. If we then had another pandemic on top of what we're coping with at the moment, there would be absolute meltdown. So I'm not convinced that it will help us handle the next pandemic better, but I'm glad it's happening because we will hear all the arguments in forensic detail and we will come up with the best analysis of it, albeit probably a bit too late to change anything for next time.
One of the other elements of the inquiry that you've been writing about is the problems of evidence that is either missing or being held back, or somehow, you know, phones have kind of gone AWOL. And this seems to be an enormously new challenge. I think something that probably didn't exist when you had your public inquiry with the Bristol Heart Inquiry. There's now so much more written communication to be sifted or mislaid.
It was interesting, wasn't it? I mean, the Good Law Project tried to get the use of WhatsApps banned, saying that it wasn't appropriate, that there needed to be proper documentation of key decisions made. And the High Court judge said, well, this is a new media. And when the Parliamentary Act was really made saying all this should be documented, we didn't have that form of communication. And they accepted that WhatsApps were like having discussions in corridors, but key decisions were still made on those groups. If you look at who was in the WhatsApp group, there were separate groups for Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance and Boris Johnson and Dominic. You know, there were clearly key pandemic discussion groups. And the public inquiry needs to see these in their entirety. We know that from the unfortunate experiences of Matt Hancock, who obviously handed all his messages to Isabel Oakeshott, and she cherry-picked the supportive ones to write nice things about him in his memoir, and then cherry-picked the destructive ones to absolutely crucify him in the Daily Telegraph. And his argument was, well, actually, it's up to the inquiry to see all my messages in their entirety to judge the context, and then that's fair enough. So he submitted them all. Johnson is being mischievous. I mean, the sight of him pretending to play the moral high ground by saying, oh, you can have all my messages from the one phone that actually isn't very relevant, plus my notebooks, is a nonsense. He's just creating trouble for Sunak. But Sunak may well have said things that he doesn't want to appear in the public inquiry. So this argument that, oh, it'll, you know, the stuff in there that's unambiguously irrelevant and it's all about Nanny's school run and what our cappuccino preferences are, well, you know, Alice is well capable of dismissing those and deciding what she thinks is relevant. And if you don't do that, there's no point in having a public inquiry. If you say that the government can choose which evidence it submits and what it chooses to redact or submit to inquiry, then it's not a public inquiry and the whole exercise is pointless. So I very much hope they lose their judicial review challenge. But of course, it buys them time. If that just delays something embarrassing by a month or two so it doesn't come out before the next election, then that's a win for Sunak and he's using public money to mount the legal challenge. Already we know that the modules in the pandemic are not chronological. And so the one that everybody wants to hear, well, the ones they want to hear about lockdown, they want to hear about what happened in care homes. Well, the care homes module now has been shifted, so it's extremely unlikely to happen before the next election. So whether or not the government laid a protective ring around care homes isn't going to be properly scrutinised. But she has said, Hallett has said, she will do interim reports. So the two that are going ahead at the moment are the one that's resilience and preparedness is what we're doing. And then we're looking at high-level political and administrative decision-making. So right. There may well be some government criticism that comes in. Jeremy Hunt is giving evidence soon, my good friends. It'll be interesting to see what he says. Hmm. He's in the unfortunate position of already having said of chair of the Health and Select Committee, he's done his own inquiry and said it was the greatest public health failure in living memory, or words to that effect. And he's now part of the government. So he's on slightly dodgy ground. Well, he was in charge of preparing us for it. So it'll be interesting to see how he is cross-examined.
How long is the overall inquiry expected to take? It sounds like we're saying certainly some years.
She says because she'll introduce publish modules as they go, the findings may come out sequentially. I think June 2026. So it will take a little while and then they'll have to assimilate it all. I personally, I mean, there are a number of things I don't think they're going to go down, but I wish they would. So I think our attitude to death and dying and how we die is absolutely fundamental. I'd like a dying module. I'm slightly unusual in my approach to journalism is that I'm not obsessed with breaking stories. I'm more obsessed with writing stories that somehow improve the NHS and understanding how science works. So I think it's absolutely okay to change position and change your mind on things as the evidence accumulates. So if somebody says the way that we implemented lockdown in the broad sweep of things caused far more harm than good, I would accept that. I thought at the time the first lockdown was important to do because we were hideously unprepared and all my colleagues in hospital were saying, look, this is just overwhelming us. But then I wrote a letter to Matt Hancock, or co-signed a letter to Matt Hancock, saying, look, if you're going to carry on doing lockdowns, can you mitigate the harm you're doing to school children and young people? So this is complex. So the thing I really would like to know is whether, with better leadership, perhaps, we could have introduced these things voluntarily. I mean, the public were right behind us. And all we, you know, we know from the science of how respiratory viruses spread, we needed to reduce large gatherings and lots of face-to-face contact. Could we, with better and more consistent communication, perhaps even using a bit of humour, have done this voluntarily? Did we need all the anger and outrage of mandatory stuff? Because the government has hoisted on its own petard, really, by coming up with these restrictions and then not being able to follow them. I think people will understand and forgive honest mistakes. What they won't forgive is deliberate rule breaking and covering it up. So that's what, you know, to me, it wasn't that difficult. When you can argue whether restrictions were necessary or not, but once they were introduced, if you were having a work gathering, it had to be reasonably necessary for work purposes. Everybody attending had to be essential to that purpose. So if you were having a cabinet office meeting, you clearly couldn't have your interior decorator in with some birthday cake to celebrate somebody's birthday. In no way, shape or form is that ever going to be reasonably necessary for work purposes. And for someone as intelligent as Boris Johnson to pretend that he had no idea that this was breaking the rules, I personally think most people, other than Jacob Rees-Mogg, most people won't forgive that, because he was clearly taking the piss and clearly breaking the rules. Some people will argue, well, that proves the rules weren't necessary in the first place, we never needed them. Other people would argue this, that he was totally unfit to govern, and that's why we had so many excess deaths. And hopefully the inquiry will reach a judgment on that. But that's the thing that fascinates me, is whether next time around we sort of know we're up and running, we know what to do, and could we do it voluntarily? Because I think that would cause less angst and anger. But some people would carry on breaking the rules and there would be some unnecessary spread. So you've got to balance all these harms out.
Phil Hammond there, and we will be covering more of the COVID inquiry over the next, what sounds like, 10 to 15 years. We will keep you posted. It will all be covered in the magazine as well. If you haven't got a copy of the magazine this fortnight, rush out and get one, or simply go to private-eye.co.uk and get a subscription so that it rushes to you. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We'll be back again soon with another one. This episode, as always, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Thanks for listening. See you next time.